KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
Yes. All right. Well, it is 9:45, so I will welcome KPTZ listeners and welcome to Dr. Berry and to Willie Bentz, who's with us by phone today. So, Dr. Berry, what do you have for us?
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. So I have mixed news today, a little bit of good news, which I don't often get to share, so that's something. Nationwide, we are starting to see cases plateau, though that really masks kind of a much more varied picture across the country. We are seeing the South, which had this really dramatic rise, start to slow down, and we are starting to see cases rise in the Midwest and the Northeast. The West side of the country is also starting to plateau. The highest case rates right now are in Tennessee and West Virginia. We're seeing a really significant transmission there, primarily related to those being some of the least vaccinated parts of the country. In Washington, we are seeing cases plateau statewide.
Recording in progress.
Though it is pretty variable across the state, still depending on vaccination status. So when you look at the state as a whole, you see a plateau, but when you get a little more granular than that, you see that your more highly vaccinated places are starting to see even some decreases in cases, and your less vaccinated places, mostly the east side of the mountains, continuing to see cases rise in those areas. But we are seeing that plateau, but it's still at a very high rate. In Washington, we're still seeing over 3,000 cases a day diagnosed for COVID-19. Hospitalizations are still increasing, but much less than before. There looks like they're starting to plateau at a statewide level, but that means about 1,800 people are hospitalized across Washington state right now. We are still seeing ICU beds at about 97% capacity. That actually is slightly better than it was on Friday when we were at 98% capacity across the state. So a little better, but still very, very full. The hospital system continues to be incredibly strained. We are still seeing deaths rise around the state. As we've discussed before, that tends to be a lagging indicator. The good news I have in Jefferson is that we are finally seeing our case rates decrease. So our total number of cases, we are up to 932, but our case rate last 2 weeks is 379 cases per 100,000. So that's a decrease from where we were last week. It's still very high, still much higher than we want it to be, but it does suggest that what we're doing is working. And if we keep doing what we are doing as a community, if we keep, following the precautions, keep avoiding, unvaccinated folks in high-risk indoor spaces, it really does make a huge difference. And so we can see this turn around. Our local hospitals are still strained, still full, but as we've discussed, hospitalization tends to follow cases about 2 to 3 weeks. So we anticipate that we are going to continue to see hospital strain for about 2 to 3 weeks, but it does mean there is light at the end of the tunnel if we keep moving in the direction we are. In Clallam County, case rates have started to dip as well, still incredibly high. We're at 1,100 cases per 100,000, but that's down from 1,200 cases per 100,000 in Clallam. So it does show direction, moving in the right direction, but still very, very high. We do have numerous long-term care facility outbreaks in Clallam County, and that affects our Jefferson Hospital system as well, because that's one of the places that folks get discharged to. Kitsap County is still seeing very high rates of infections, 572 cases per 100,000, and multiple long-term care facility outbreaks as well. So the summary of that is we are seeing improvement in Jefferson. We're moving in the right direction. Case rates are still very high. Hospital systems are still very strained. But if we keep doing what we're doing, I think we really can continue to turn this around and get to a much better place. That's really a lot of what I brought prepared for you. What questions do the commissioners have?
Greg or Heidi?
I don't have a lot right now. It's great to see, hopefully, the past the crest of the wave. So thank you for that. And I'm glad to hear that we're doing the right things. Obviously, we still have community spread. I was at the Quilcene Fair last week, and it was really impressive to see, I would say, more than 90% of the folks were masked outdoors, you know, where there was, you know, a little jamming of elbows and not quite as much personal space. But I guess just if you could reiterate for us best practices when we are meeting in these larger outdoor gatherings. And then my other, you know, corollary to that is churches. There's a celebration of the Presbyterian Church in Quilcene next Sunday that I'm planning to go to. And I just want to know, what's the safe way that one can attend a service as a vaccinated individual?
Yeah, so as far as masking, best practice, so anytime you're in an indoor environment, you know, with outside of kind of your household or your pod, best practice is to mask. When it comes to outdoor environments, in most cases, it is still really safe, and you don't have to mask if you're walking down the street, going for a run, things like that. But if you're in a crowded outdoor environment where you see a lot of people really close together, like a concert, like a fair, wearing masks is best practice. It is recommended. And it is now required in the state of Washington. If you have over 500 people in a space, in a crowded outdoor space, then you do have to wear a mask in those spaces. One of the primary data points that drove that was fairs. We saw really dramatic rises in cases after county fairs, a lot on the east side of the mountains, and then around the Washington State Fair in the Puyallup area. And so it is good to keep a mask on in those spaces. A lot of times we're eating when we're at fairs because the food is delicious. Step back from other people when you're going to have to take your mask off for those kind of things. And then church, yes. So there are ways to do church well. And so primarily masking in indoor spaces, including if you're vaccinated. So wearing a mask when you're at church. And a lot of it has to do with how the church sets things up. So if you have spacing between family groups, that is ideal. Opening windows, letting fresh air into the church, those all help a lot. And then some churches have decided to go to, if you're coming to in-person services, that you do need to be vaccinated. That certainly protects everyone who's there for those indoor spaces. But the biggest thing is wear your mask, keep some space. If you can talk to your church about opening windows and doors, let some fresh air flow in, that makes a huge difference.
Two more questions following up on that. Sure. One is, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, I was doing a lot of research into effective ways to both clean indoor air with ventilation and how to evaluate that. And, you know, the idea that if you get a carbon monitor up there or something to see if you are cycling air and how frequently you're cycling all of the air. And I'm wondering, as we're through this, if there is an easy kind of turnkey solution that one could get for an office or a home or something that to help you evaluate the air turnover and ventilation effectiveness. And then I'm also just wondering if you can give us kind of a pulse check on schools. I know there have been some cases there. I haven't heard of any transmission that's taking place at school. And I'm just wondering how we're doing just keeping that critical group of kids together.
Sure. So ventilation wise, we have learned a lot more about ventilation and how to know if you're doing it well. It really comes down to what's called air exchanges. So really how well you're moving air. There are some kind of, you know, advertised filters that aren't really moving air that much and you're just kind of doing something there. You really want to move the air through. You want new air in and the current air out. So air exchanges is really where the money is. As far as how you measure it, the CO2 monitors are extremely good. So if you can get to the same CO2 level as outside, so that suggests that you're really doing a good job moving air. It's a somewhat complicated process, but I do think we can probably link to some of the State Department of Health resources on ventilation from our website so that people can kind of dig into it and see what fits their space the best. But even adding a HEPA filter that a lot of us add during kind of smoky season or things like that actually does make a difference in an indoor space. That is part of we use very large ones, but part of how we make those negative air pressure rooms at hospitals is with HEPA filters. And a quick check-in on the schools. So our schools continue to do very well. We are We are seeing sporadic cases, kids getting who are positive, but they're not getting it at school, they're getting it at home. And then we're finding out about it because they're getting tested through school-based testing. And so that that really speaks to the power of that program, especially for some of our more rural districts that had less access to testing before. I think part of it is we were just finding cases that we were missing before. But it is, and we've not had any in-school, in-classroom transmission. We have had sports team transmission that has happened, and it's exclusively when sports come inside. So, I remember when we were talking about sports back in the day, people were saying, like, well, I can't imagine how you could spread it in baseball. And that's true. In an actual baseball game, you're not going to spread COVID-19. But what happens is when you come into the locker room, that then becomes a problem. Or if you have, if you have any indoor play or indoor gym workout as well. So I will be meeting with the superintendents tomorrow, and we will be talking about additional mitigations to reduce the risk of spread related to sports so that we can prioritize that in-person learning.
If I could follow up a little bit on that, Dr. Berry, my daughter is playing high school sports and getting tested weekly, which is great. But I did hear that they're starting to worry about a shortage of testing supplies. So I'll be bringing that up at policy management too, but might be good to check in with the superintendents this week to see if they're all experiencing that. I know Willie's trying to get some more test kits, but it is really great to have that testing to ensure they're catching cases.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is primarily nationwide shortages of the test kit infrastructure, particularly the rapid tests that we like to use in schools so that we can find the results and kind of act on them quickly. It's the rapid tests that we're running short of nationwide right now, just because when the whole country needs something at the same time, it's really hard to meet that demand. And so if we do get to that point, there are some things that we would be decreasing, and it would be this kind of asymptomatic screening testing would be kind of one of the first things that we would change, but we would still test for symptomatic kids. And I think the only other thing I would speak to is that the schools are doing an incredible job with contact tracing, but it is a big strain on their resources to try to trace all these cases. We are going to keep supporting them as much as we can, but as a community, one of the biggest things we can do is give them less cases to trace. If we reduce our community transmission, that allows our schools to focus more on teaching our kids.
I have a couple more questions, if you don't mind. Just as a reminder, am I remembering correctly that the kind of maximum number we would like to see our case rate at is 75 per 100,000. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's the trigger for thinking we're at high transmission rate, which sounds so small now that we've gotten used to being in these hundreds, but that's where we feel like we actually have this relatively well under.
So we have a long way to go.
We do.
I'm curious. I'm hearing, and I think you talked about this in the PDN this week, and I'm wondering if you can just help clarify. There's a number of people have been bringing concerns about outbreaks at assisted living facilities, of course, and that's where we've seen a number of deaths. Can you speak to, is it largely the case that the source of those infections is unvaccinated workers in those facilities?
That is the number one way that COVID gets into long-term care is unvaccinated staff. But we have had cases where the initial introduction was actually an unvaccinated visitor as well. So visitors to family, and usually what happens is they infect the family member. And then what really makes these large outbreaks is staff. Because if you've ever been in or worked in a long-term care facility, usually that one staff member works with nearly all the patients. And so if they are infectious, which they often are, especially when they're unvaccinated, they just walk it down and give it to everybody. And so that is the primary driver of these very large outbreaks. When we see these smaller outbreaks that are two or three cases, that's something that can be more commonly related to just a visitor and a patient. It seems like the really number one thing that makes these massive is unvaccinated staff. That's how it spreads in there because the patients don't travel much. They aren't really capable of spreading it themselves.
Thank you for that clarification. And just one more question, and we talked about it a little bit in our policy management group meeting last week, but have you heard any further interpretation on whether the OSHA rules and the federal vaccination mandate will apply to local governments?
It does look like it will. So the federal mandate that if you are an employer over 100, that your employees will have to be vaccinated or test weekly is very likely going to apply to our local government because it's it has to do with whether or not your state has an OSHA plan. We do. And so what will happen is the federal government still has to write the details of their order. And then Washington State has a period of time to come up with an order which is either the same or more stringent than what has come down from the federal government. And then that would apply to Jefferson County. So that it will apply to us. It's just the specifics of how it applies to us that remain to be seen.
Okay. Greg, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, to follow up on that, I'm just, you know, as we run into a dearth of testing now, adding 100 million more people where somewhere between around 20%, you know, optimistically are going to have to test every week. How is that possibly going to work?
I don't know that it will. Certainly I know that the federal government is working to increase production of testing supplies, and that's always welcome. I mean, goodness knows we've wanted to have more testing for a year and a half, but I am worried about that requirement and whether or not we can meet it. I think it's better practice to do what we've seen done in Washington, which is to say, if you're going to work in a certain profession, indoors, in person, that you have to be vaccinated and leave the testing requirements to those who are truly exempt, who have a medical exemption or have a religious exemption that dramatically reduces the drag on testing. And it also is more effective. Weekly testing is really unlikely to make a significant difference in transmission without a larger vaccine mandate on it.
Okay, now that's going to be complicated.
Mark, you guys got to most of mine. I was going to ask about schools. There have been some national headlines about in other areas, you know, schools being problematic. And I just think it's important that we always clarify what our local situation is on in this forum, just so that, because I'm getting a lot of questions about schools from people in my community. So I just think it'd be good to put it as a standing agenda item for every week to reiterate what's happening here for schools instead of people who read the Washington Post or whatever and go, oh God, you know. So I appreciate you localizing the information for us, Dr. Berry. And the testing issue, we also talked about that in our COVID coordination meeting with county departments last Friday, and it made me start thinking over the weekend, should we be, you know, I mean, I know we're not wanting anyone to start hoarding test kits, but should we be accumulating an ample supply, anticipating a certain percentage of our team will opt for that option?
Yeah, I think when it comes to testing, I think a lot of people are having that thought right now, which is challenging because I think if we all do it, then we're in trouble. So I would say right now, if there was anywhere I was prioritizing tests, it would be schools, so we can keep up the rapid testing. And then we'll wait to see what comes down from the state. It's possible that the state requirement will be more stringent, will not even give the test out option. We don't know. So I would hold tight for that. But yes, I'm happy to make schools a stable part of our updates now that they are in session. And I think it is important to differentiate. It's very different here than what you're reading about in a lot of the rest of the country because we are practicing all these safe practices. It's not an accident. It's, you know, the spacing, it's the cohorting, it's the masking, it's the testing. It's all of those things together that reduce transmission. And even in places like Eastern Washington, where we're seeing really dramatic rates of transmission, the schools that are following the guidance are not seeing lots of transmission. But the ones that have decided that the guidance doesn't apply, that's where we're seeing massive outbreaks and schools shutting down again.
Thank you.
Mark, anything? Okay, should we move to Willie?
No, I'm okay, I'm good.
Okay. KPTZ questions, is that?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
I know I never get through all of them, so I want to try. So this one had a lot of questions kind of around bubbles and safety. So this one was particularly for grandparents who have young children in their that have been in their bubble. What do you do now that they're going to school? And I think that, you know, does that mean that you can still be around those kids as fully vaccinated grandparents? These particular children in question were 6 and 3, so too young to be vaccinated themselves. I think key to remember, any grandkids 12 or over, best protection for everyone is get them vaccinated. But for the kids under 12, I would say that what we are continuing to see is that school is the safest place for kids. There is much less transmission in schools than we are seeing in the community. The only exception to that rule is if you have a kid who you have really been quarantining, who really is staying home. And that has been true for some of our very medically fragile children, is that they really are staying home and not gathering with others. But outside of that group, generally we see more transmission in the community than we see in schools. It does pose some risk. There is some transmission. We have had, you know, one case in Clallam County of transmission in schools, so it can happen, but it is rare if your school and your kids are following protocols. And so if your children are good at mask wearing, they know all the COVID rules, and if they're going to a school that is honoring the requirements and doing a good job with them, I think the added risk to your family is actually relatively low. A much higher risk if your family is socializing. So if those kids are gathering with other kids indoors unrelated to school, that's a much higher risk interaction than school. Other ones. This one is, we are in our mid to late 70s. We're both fully vaccinated. One of us had Pfizer and the other one of us had Moderna. Neither of us had any reaction. And basically, does this mean that we're not covered? And so that's actually a question we've been getting a little bit more lately. I think people are nervous about if their vaccine is working. I think the key thing to know there is we talk a lot about vaccine reactions. They're, we all kind of prepped everybody for them, but they still only happen in about 20 to 40% of people. So it's, most people just don't talk about it if they don't get a reaction from their vaccine. It does not mean your vaccine didn't work. It's not as common as you would think by how often we talk about it. So if you didn't get a significant reaction, I would not fear that your vaccine isn't working. It very likely is, but it's a good time to remember that the vaccines are not 100%. So that's why we wear masks. That's why when transmission is really high, especially if we're, over 65, that we really try to keep that bubble small to reduce any additional exposures. It's not, it's a very good protection, but it's not an impenetrable shield. So do continue to be thoughtful in that way, but I wouldn't fear if you haven't had a significant reaction. That's okay. This person wanted to know a little bit more about the breakthrough cases. So primarily, what are the characteristics of those folks who have had severe disease, even though they had COVID, and even though they were fully vaccinated? And the primary unifying characteristic among people who have been hospitalized or even died who were fully vaccinated is that they lived in a long-term care facility. That is the number one risk factor for not being able to fully respond to your vaccine and to a severe case of COVID, and unfortunately, in some cases, death. So I'd say that's number one. The next most common cause of severe COVID-19 in people who are fully vaccinated is that they were immunosuppressed. So they were on, advanced immunosuppressing medications, or they had active cancer, so like leukemia, things like that, that we know, even without COVID in the mix, make it hard for your immune system to respond. That's pretty much all of the ones that have been severe have fallen into those two categories. We did have one case of a person who was in their upper 90s, who didn't have those other things, but their primary risk factor there was just age. Their immune system wasn't as able to respond based on their age. The only other thing they asked for, whether or not these folks were gathering with unvaccinated people? Yes, sometimes not by their own choice. So they had unvaccinated people taking care of them. Or the most common way a very elderly person gets exposed is either they're living in long-term care or a family member is unvaccinated. Who cares for them? And so I think it is a good reminder that for our highest risk people, you want to create a bubble of protection around them. So that means everyone in their life needs to get vaccinated who can. Same thing goes for very young children as well. So we've done this for a long time with new babies. We recommend everybody get the flu shot around them. We now recommend everybody around them get a COVID shot too. Anyone who's going to be gathering with a newborn really should be fully vaccinated. A couple other questions, got a little more time. So this one is about, there's some Jefferson County residents returning from Australia who were fully vaccinated there. Will their vaccine card count to get them into restaurants? Yes. And most restaurants won't be used to seeing that. So they'll need to explain it, be ready to explain it. But I think, you know, if you're showing a good faith effort, you really had a real vaccination card, most places are gonna accept that. That will count. The other thing that you can do, I don't want to strain the healthcare system right now, but you can get it added to the Washington immunization record once you're here, the next time you're happening to see your PCP. And so then it will get into WATRAC, which is what puts it on an app on your phone. This one says, do I have the right to ask a medical provider if they are fully vaccinated? Yes, you do. They don't have to answer, but I think it's a reasonable question. If you are receiving healthcare, it is reasonable to expect that the person who is providing you healthcare has done everything they can to keep you safe. You know, it's always been reasonable to ask if they wash their hands. There are lots of things that we need to do to keep you safe in a healthcare setting. And so I think it's reasonable to ask. I think you will find that the vast majority of healthcare providers you ask will say yes. Many of us have actually started kind of sporting our vaccination status at work so that our patients can know. And we've got little wristbands, things like that. But yes, it's okay to ask. Some people won't want to answer that, but it's a reasonable question. If you're receiving healthcare services. Another question about pods. Is the county suggesting that vaccinated only share pods with other vaccinated? I have a few friends who are not vaccinated and I would like to see them. They are very reserved and following all the local rules. Any suggestions? So I would say your pod is safer if it's fully vaccinated, you know, so anytime you're gathering with unvaccinated folks, that does increase risk. That doesn't mean you can't do it. But you want to think about making that as safe as possible. So you want that number to be small. You want that if you can gather outdoors, all the better. And then it's also reasonable to ask them about their gathering habits. So that bubble gets really big. If you think you're in a bubble with one person, but they're actually in a bubble with 20 other people. And so it's important to establish and have those conversations about who your bubble is. Make sure you're all on the same page with that. There are some folks who truly can't get vaccinated. That number is small. And I would encourage talking to your friends about getting vaccinated if they aren't yet, if they don't have a, you know, true medical contraindication to that. Just be respectful, be kind, be open. And those conversations can often go quite well. This question is, I think, an important one. So they said, I read somewhere that vaccinated people carry the same viral load as non-vaccinated. And so is this accurate? Actually, no. So that was an early case report about a single large outbreak on the East Coast. And what they found was that in that one case, that the vaccinated folks who did come down with the infection had as much viral load as the non-vaccinated folks. They've then gone on to study that in much larger numbers. And what they have found is that the vaccinated folks had less what's called viable virus, which is the virus that can infect other people. They might have had little pieces of virus that can't infect anybody, but they had less of the stuff that matters, the stuff that can infect other people. So you are much less likely to transmit COVID if you are vaccinated. You're less likely to get it, so you can't spread anything you don't have. And then if you are unlucky enough to get COVID, even though you're fully vaccinated, you'll have less viable virus that can infect people in your nose, and you're contagious for a shorter period of time. So vaccinated people tend to be contagious for about 3 days. Unvaccinated people tend to be significantly contagious for 10 days. So it does make a difference. It's not 100%, but it does reduce transmission and reduce your risk of giving COVID to other people. This question says, how many people are being admitted to local hospitals with severe reactions to the COVID-19 vaccine? And that's a really good question and important to answer because it is zero. There is no one who has been admitted to our local hospitals with a severe reaction to COVID-19. You'll hear other stuff online. It's not real. We certainly have, there are severe reactions. You know, we had some cases of anaphylaxis, especially in the early rollout when we were, you know, giving thousands of vaccines every weekend. Just statistically, that's going to happen. They were treated. Most of them recovered in the next, in the ER in a couple hours, but there is no one in our hospitals right now related to vaccines. The hospital strain is exclusively from COVID-19. This person referenced VAERS, and I think it is important to reiterate that. So VAERS is a database that the CDC has put up online. It's open access. So it's like Wikipedia. Anyone can put anything into it. It is not maintained by the CDC. So you might find some weird stuff in there. That's usually because someone put it there. But that doesn't make it true. Just like if you see something really weird on Wikipedia, question it. The same thing is true with VAERS. The CDC built it with the best intentions of mind, which is they wanted everybody to be able to share if anything happened to them after they had a vaccine. They didn't expect it to get used this way. And unfortunately, it has been co-opted by some groups who want to spread misinformation. So if you see people saying, I saw it in VAERS, think Wikipedia in your head and give it a big grain of salt. I have seen non-medical surgical masks or things that are listed as non-medical at the store. Does that count? Yes. What that means is those are still good masks. It means they don't quite meet the rigorous infection control standard of being an actual surgeon, which is not what you need for your life. So when I'm wearing something outside of the clinic setting, it is a non-medical surgical mask. So that's what you're going to see in most stores. It's totally fine. And then, I'm going to make it to my last question. A neighbor had said she would not get vaccinated until the vaccine received full approval. And then she was still not vaccinated. So I asked her why she didn't get the Pfizer shot. And she said her chiropractor told her that the vaccine in circulation right now is not the fully approved one. So the reason why it's important to go over that is that that's totally false. That's a piece of misinformation you might be seeing circulated online or maybe by an unfortunate chiropractor. But the Pfizer vaccine is Comirnaty. They're the same. They're just two names for the same vaccine. Comirnaty is the brand name. Pfizer is the company that made it. They are the same vaccine. It's the same one that's always been out. In fact, it is the one that we originally got. As we just reorder as we run out. So it's the same one we've been vaccinating with this whole time. It's the same one that hundreds of, that just shocking amounts of people worldwide have gotten and been safe. So if you want a fully approved vaccine, go get Pfizer or Comirnaty, same drug.
If I could jump in with one more, Dr. Barry, can you help us? There was a lot of news in the last few days about efficacy of vaccinations long-term after the four-month mark and conflicting information about boosters. Can you just give me kind of your Reader's Digest interpretation at this point about what to make of that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of information out there, and we're running into the same challenge we ran into in the beginning of the pandemic, which is what's called preprint articles. So in an effort to get research out to people as fast as possible, there's a bunch of stuff getting put on the internet before it's had peer review. So if you see something that says it's preprint, also read it with a grain of salt. That means no other doctors and epidemiologists have looked at it to see if their conclusions make any sense at all. So just know that. As far as long-term efficacy of the vaccines, the best available evidence we have is that they are still really good for the vast majority of people. We do see some decrease in efficacy. So from the 80s, 86, 87% efficacy in against Delta. For people under 75, we see it drop to the 70s, so like 76% effective for people over 75. That's still a really good vaccine. A 76% effective vaccine is still really good, but we've just gotten used to seeing things like 95. So they're still really, really good. We are starting to see some early waning in this older population, which is part of why we're talking more about boosters. So the FDA met to talk about the possibility of boosters, and it looks like they are likely, their advisory committee is likely to recommend boosters for people over 65 and healthcare workers. That's likely, they haven't said it for sure. And then there's a group called ACIP, or the American College of Immunization Practices, who then has to meet and make their recommendations. So we're not quite there yet. It could be 65 and up and healthcare workers. It could be 75 up and healthcare workers. Could be just 75 and up. We don't know yet. But we're likely to know the final answer in the next week or so. And we are always preparing and adjusting our plans so that we'll be ready to go as soon as that vaccination recommendation comes out. I just want to touch on, along the same line, I'm seeing a lot of information circulated about the idea that natural immunity, quote unquote, is better than getting vaccinated. I would really caution against that. So there's a piece of research that's being circulated that came out of potentially that people who had already had COVID had more long-lasting immunity than people who are vaccinated. What's not being shared is the competing article that came out of Europe that was even larger and didn't find that same conclusion. And so that kind of comes onto the into this space where people kind of pick and choose the articles that they want to see. I would say the jury is out on which, you know, whether getting COVID or getting vaccinated is more powerful. One thing that we do know is that if you've had COVID, it is not clear that you're fully protected. There is a subset of people, and right now current estimates are about 20% that have no immunity at all. Even though they had COVID before. And so that's why you're seeing that we still are saying, if you've had COVID, you should still get vaccinated. Because one thing that we really do know is if you got COVID and then get vaccinated, you are incredibly well protected and it's very safe. So if you've had COVID, still get vaccinated. It'll make all the difference in keeping you from getting infected in the future. It still makes a huge difference. And the biggest reason why we don't go towards this, you know, everybody get infected, herd immunity, is that the consequences would be devastating. So if we could do that, we would have done it a long time ago. But unfortunately, we are seeing what happens when even 5 to 10% of us get COVID and it crushes our healthcare system, it crushes our school system. We can't do it. You know, the estimates I have for Clallam County, I haven't repeated them for Jefferson yet, I will, is that in Clallam County, if we let the virus just run, we would see approximately 2,000 people dead from COVID alone. And so that's why we don't do herd immunity, is because the death toll would be unimaginable. So we try to get there in a much safer, more effective way, which is getting vaccinated.
Trouble unmuting. Okay, thank you. Anything else for Dr. Berry? All right, Willie.
Really quick, welcome. I'm sorry. Can you speak? I'm sorry. We're giving 8 minutes to Willie. He wouldn't even know what to do with 8 minutes. I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit about crystal ball on kids 5 to 11. I've been reading a lot about that this past weekend as well, on the Pfizer vaccine and the dosage.
So far, it's still looking like most likely mid-October for kids 5 to 11, but it's really depends on how fast the FDA moves on the data that they get. It's looking like Pfizer is going to give them their data end of September, which is coming up quick. And then it depends on how fast that review process goes. But most likely what we've seen so far is they take a week to review the data, and then ACIP takes another week to meet. And then once that's done, it's available. So we are thinking mid-October, based on what we're seeing. And the data does look, you know, the preliminary reports of the data that we're seeing from the feds to the state to us is that it is really good. It's a very effective vaccine and an incredibly safe one.
All right. Okay. So welcome, Willie, joining us by phone today.
Hey, thank you, Commissioner. First things for me is that we had another successful clinic this past weekend for the immunosuppressed. We had 65 people come out to Blue Heron, and we thank them for their partnership. And again, really appreciate the work our vaccine team is doing providing those clinics for those folks. That's currently our last planned large clinic for the immunosuppressed population. But again, it is recommended they get that third dose, since their immune systems being compromised, didn't produce as robust a reaction to the vaccine as others did. So that third dose helps give them full protection. They can still get that third dose through their primary care physician, at pharmacies, et cetera. So again, that'll be our last clinic for that specific population. We do have one more private clinic for healthcare providers and other folks to meet the governor's vaccine mandate. That goes into effect October 18th, which means to be fully vaccinated by that date, folks will need to get their Johnson & Johnson single dose if they haven't started a series already by October 4th. So we have one more private clinic to help out employers, help their employees meet that upcoming deadline. Again, please reach out to us. That deadline is fast approaching. You only have just a couple more weeks to either complete your series or get J&J as your one dose. Other than that, we're carefully watching what's going on with the 5 to 11 population, that potential approval, as well as the potential approval for booster doses for the general population. So we'll be hopefully ready to strike once that announcement and formal recommendation is made. The key piece of messaging here is just that we'll find out about that approval at the same time you all do. So we've done a lot of pre-planning. We're very comfortable where we're at. We're going to be ready to go. We just won't have clinics announced instantaneously. So that'll come just a day or two later. Once that announcement is made, please pay attention to the public health website for announcement on our plans for either, again, the 5 to 11 population or booster doses for 65 plus, 75 plus, whatever it might be. But we will be ready for that. On to testing, I just want to touch base that both public health and DEM, we are doing our best to request and secure testing. But as Dr. Berry said, the demand just way outpaces the supply. And unfortunately, it's because the primary reason is that a lot of folks that there was light at the end of the tunnel, numbers were down, things were looking pretty good in terms of COVID-19. But then we relaxed protocol and then we're hit really hard by the Delta variant. And so supply just hasn't been able to catch up with that demand. There was even at a certain point, there was one rapid antigen testing company who was actually destroying their testing stock because there wasn't a demand, nor did they foresee the demand. So very unfortunate situation there. Again, we're continuing to put in requests. We'll do our best to stockpile what we can. Thankfully, supply should start opening up as they are doing a lot of work at the federal level to help meet the demand. But again, at this point in time, every county across the nation is having the same exact conversation we're having. So we'll keep doing our due diligence and we'll try to bolster testing capacity to the best that we possibly can. Other than that, the last thing I wanted to touch on, non-COVID related, because of course, just because we're in a pandemic, other disasters don't get paused. We had our first little taste of winter weather this past weekend. We had some pretty high winds, some much needed rain. I'm very thankful for that moisture. And because it was the first storm of the season, it knocked loose a lot of dry debris. That first wind that always comes through tends to shake everything that's been drying out over the course of the summer loose. It knocks over a lot of dead and rotting trees, and it creates a lot of issues for us. I know a lot of folks throughout the county had lost power, maybe briefly, maybe for a little bit longer, and do want to give a shout out to our PUD for all the great work they did, as well as the great work Public Works did in clearing the roads for all of us. And just want to ask that this serve as a reminder for folks that winter is indeed coming. Check on your preparedness kit. Make sure you got batteries in the flashlight. Check on your generator, all that sort of fun stuff. So again, just a request. People realize we're in a pandemic, and I know things are tough, but it's still important to be ready for other potential hazardous events. Other than that, that's all I've got, barring any questions.
All right, any questions for Willie?
I would just add, Willie, I noticed that DNR just lifted the burn ban. So we are officially, hopefully around that corner.
That rain.
Go ahead.
Oh, Willie. Go ahead.
I was just gonna ask, but our local burn ban stays in place, correct? Mm-hmm. The DNR is for the DNR properties or?
Statewide burn ban, so.
Usually ours is over at Labor Day. I think we were kept it longer because of that statewide one. So I don't know. I usually take my cue from the little signs poked in the ground. So I'll double check. But I'd heard Chief Black referencing the state burn ban is the reason it wasn't over. So I think it will be the trigger.
Yeah, I think so. I think it triggers ours too, because it says state lands and private lands in the press release. So we'll want to get confirmation, but it looks like we're turning that corner.
You know, Willie?
No, I can't speak definitively to that. I haven't heard anything officially from our local fire chiefs, so I would defer to them. But again, with the state burn ban being lifted, I'm sure if ours wasn't an automatic trigger, I'm assuming it'll soon follow. But again, I'll defer to them for that confirmation.
Thank you.
I'll just echo Willie's, thanks for the good work of PUD and Public Works. It was pretty crazy down the South End. I always get to check my generator, when the first power outage goes. It was only 12 hours this time, so no big deal. But everyone check your preparedness kit and make sure you have water and batteries. Oh, and Willie, I don't think you spoke of it, but can you talk about the vaccine clinic that is planned out of the fairgrounds in the American Legion again? Is that DEM?
Anything specific you wanted to know? I don't have the date off the top of my head. But we got that request, and that'll be an open clinic. It won't be for a specific population or private or anything like that. But again, I don't have the date right off the top. I can look that up if you want.
If you could, I didn't get the date. I know it's coming, and partially to facilitate the move of the campers over to the Mill Road property and just make sure that everyone's as safe as possible. And I know that it is open to all. So if you can get that data, I'd appreciate it, so we can let the public know.
But he's working on that. Heidi's talking to the fire chief. We're doing this in real time. What do you have for us, Heidi?
I was calling the fire chief.
Did you get any answer?
Nope. I left him a message.
Okay. Darn. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll come back with that answer shortly. All right, well, we are at 10:30, so thank you very much, Dr. Berry, for all your hard work. Thank you, Willie. Appreciate the good work of emergency management, and we'll see you next week.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting.